loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, busloads of Central American migrants arrived in Tijuana, Mexico yesterday, where they intend to turn themselves into U.S. border authorities and to ask for asylum. Most of the migrants are from Honduras and are fleeing crime, violence, and political repression in that country. The Trump administration, however, is warning that anybody without a valid claim will be swiftly deported, and anybody who tries to cross the border will be arrested and prosecuted. Next, a Filipino human rights activist scheduled to speak across the country was detained upon arrival at San Francisco Airport and will likely be deported today. A Customs and Border Protection officer said there was a problem with Jaron Abba's visa, but Abba maintains that customs officers planted a weapon on him and tortured him while he was first detained. Then the Taliban announced the start of their annual spring offensive today, dismissing an offer of peace talks by President Ashraf Ghani and pledging to focus on attacking only U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Ghani had called for peace talks without any preconditions, but the Taliban refused, calling the offer a conspiracy. And then Pakistan's former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is on trial in that country on myriad corruption charges. He and his family have been major political players in Pakistan for most of the last 30 years and have been accused of corruption before. But allegations of Sharif having assets beyond his means, leaked as part of the Panama Papers, may be enough to finally put him in prison. And finally, Facebook yesterday made public for the very first time a 27-page memo explaining the criteria for banning content on its site. The company also said that it would be more clear about its privacy policies in light of a new European Union law mandating transparency. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Tijuana, Mexico, which sits on the border with California. Busloads of Central American migrants arrived in Tijuana yesterday, where they intend to turn themselves in to U.S. border authorities and to ask for asylum. Most of the migrants are from Honduras and are fleeing crime, violence, and political repression in that country. The Trump administration, however, is warning that anybody without a valid claim will be swiftly deported, and anybody who tries to cross the border will be arrested and prosecuted. We're joined from Seattle by Jorge Barón. He's the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. Jorge, welcome back to the show.
Thank you again for having me on.
Jorge, can you explain to our listeners, because I think most Americans don't understand what the purpose of the caravan has been. It started at Mexico's southern border, and it made its way through Mexico and now has arrived in Tijuana. Why are they doing this?
Well, I think this has actually happened in the past, so I think it's important to note that this is not a new thing. And I think part of the reason, this is part of a trend that's happened over many years, of course, of people who are fleeing the area that's known as the Northern Triangle in Central America, particularly Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, who are escaping, you know, very high levels of violence, a lot of persecution. For a number of reasons, people are leaving. And one of the challenges is, of course, the journey to safety in the United States is a dangerous one. So rather than travel individually, a number of people have come together and some organizations have helped them in this process to make sure that they are not subjected to some of the dangers, which include things like sexual assault, kidnappings, from people who are trying to take advantage of their humanitarian plight. And that's the reason that they're in this larger group. Of course, a lot of other people flee, you know, in separate groups, and some of the people have ended up leaving the larger caravan and are traveling individually. But that's the rationale for this group that is traveling and is arriving at the U.S. border now.
I did some work 10 years ago in Guatemala, and I was shocked at the level of violence in that country, the level of crime. And also at the level of American intervention that the Guatemalans had seen over the years. A lot of Guatemalans tried to make their way to the United States, not because they were economic refugees, but because they really were under threat of violence in their own country. Now, is that or should it not be criteria for entering the United States, even on a temporary basis?
Well, and it is, because in under international law, you know, there's the Refugee Convention that thinks of exactly this kind of situation where people are not able to be safe in their home country, and so they feel forced to leave their home country and seek refuge in another place. And our country has already, through the asylum protections and our refugee program, kind of established and acknowledged the reality that some people are not going to be safe in their home countries, and a process, certainly not as robust a process as I would like to see, and the way that we're implementing these protections. But these are things that are already envisioned in international law, and even our laws recognize that some people who arrive at our borders are to be given protection. So I think there's a lot of conversation in all of this that envisions that this is somehow, you know, illegal or breaks law, but this is actually precisely what's envisioned. And as you mentioned, you know, the reason that people are leaving is because of the very high levels of violence. When folks say, well, this is really about economics, I say, well, why are people not leaving other countries in the region, right? We're not seeing as many people leaving from other countries, even if they have the same economic level of prosperity. And so I think that's what's really telling about why people are leaving.
There are about 600 people in this caravan, and CNN interviewed many of them. CNN is saying they interviewed most of them. And they said that the reasons that they've given for fleeing their country, and again, most of them are from Honduras, are widespread gang violence, which we know all about here in the United States. We know that that's true. Domestic violence, poverty, political repression after a contested presidential election, and discrimination against the transgender community. Now, U.S. officials have already made it crystal clear that they are skeptical of these motives. They claim that everybody's an economic refugee and that they'll be swiftly deported. So let's say that the people who are participating in the caravan stick to their guns. What happens next? What's the next part of the process? And do you think that this is going to result in a standoff there on the border?
Well, I'm certainly concerned about that, because certainly the way that the administration is talking about this is as if this is an invasion, and you know, talking about it in terms of like national security, and you know, a lot of the people are traveling. We're talking about young mothers with young children and families who are trying to avoid many of the situations that you've described, and so I am concerned that the fact that the president has used this as an excuse to, call out the National Guard, that we're responding to a humanitarian crisis with a military response. Our laws, as I mentioned earlier, envision that people are going to be able to seek protection, and there's ways that they can go through a process to be able to present their claims. And so that's what we should be focusing on, is trying to figure out how we identify people who qualify for protection under our existing laws. But I'm concerned that they're not going to be given even that opportunity, right? That the administration has already sort of made up their minds that they don't want any of these people to be able to allow to be stay in the country. So I'm deeply concerned that folks who clearly would, it's already very hard for them to be able to get, protection, right? Because there's no right to legal counsel, appointed legal counsel in these proceedings. And a lot of folks don't have the resources, needless to say, fleeing these situations to be able to get private attorneys. So, but, on top of that, now the administration seems to be, ready to send people back without even considering their claims. So I am concerned about how this is going to play out in the coming days and weeks.
I want to read you a very short passage from CNN.com today. It says here at the outset, about 1,200 migrants from Central America were part of the caravan, but some individuals and smaller groups have split off along the way. Some sought asylum in Mexico, saying that the risk of trying to make it to the United States wasn't worth it. The members of the caravan arriving in Tijuana say they're well aware of the risks, but decided to continue the journey because they had no other choice. Angry tweets from President Donald Trump didn't sway them, and neither did deployment of the National Guard. And this is what's most shocking to me. This is a quote. "I understand that we may not be welcomed by all," a 38-year-old woman from El Salvador told CNN, "but I don't have an option. If I stay in El Salvador, I'm going to be killed." A 34-year-old friend of hers, who also asked not to be named out of fear for her safety, put it even more bluntly. Quote, "If they send me back, they might as well just send me to the grave," unquote. Is that really what these intending, intending refugees, but is that what these refugees or migrants are really facing? Is it that serious in their home countries?
This is very consistent. I mean, we have seen, particularly in the last 5-6 years, significant increase in people being forced to leave their home countries in Central America. And I have met and I've interviewed people from that region, and it's very consistent. And unfortunately, I mean, the journey that people have to undertake, this is, you know, it's hard for many of us to comprehend the dangers that people face, that many people die during this journey. And so why would people do this, right, if it was only for economic reasons? And again, you know, it's not happening from other countries. It is we see it happening in countries that have very high levels of violence. And the people that we're seeing are people who are, you know, experiencing situations where the alternative of remaining in their home country is, you know, a very high likelihood that they're going to be killed or harmed. And so, you know, I always sort of, when I talk to community members here and sort of the broader community, I say, you know, what would any of us do if we're confronted with that kind of situation? And thankfully, most of us never have to confront that question, at least here in the U.S. But unfortunately, way too many people in Central America, and particularly in places like Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala, are having to face that question and are making what, you know, for most of us would be the reasonable choice of finding safety for themselves and their families.
Jorge, we've got about 30 seconds left. Tell us how people can get involved in the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project.
Well, we encourage them to visit our website to learn more about our work. It's www.nwirp.org. And we, you know, I think it's just important. There's a network of organizations throughout the country that are, you know, pushing back on these kind of policies and trying to welcome and provide assistance to people who are fleeing very dangerous situations. So we'd encourage everybody to continue to be involved in this issue.
Indeed. I agree completely. We were joined from Seattle by Jorge Barón. He's the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project, NWIRP.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A Filipino human rights activist scheduled for a speaking tour in the United States was detained upon arrival at San Francisco Airport. A Customs and Border Protection officer said there was a problem with Jerome Abba's visa, but Abba maintains that customs officers planted a weapon on him and tortured him when he was first detained. We're joined from San Jose by Adrian Bonifacio, national chairperson of Anakbayan USA, and we are joined by Mong Palatino. He is a journalist and a former member of the Philippines House of Representatives, who was set to be on the same speaking tour as Jerome Abba. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Adrian, let's start with you. This story is harrowing. Mr. Abba, Jerome Abba, finally got in front of the media and told a story about being taken into a room, a stainless room is what he called it. I'm assuming that means Spartan or stainless steel, something of the sort, and made to strip naked and kept in front of an industrial-sized fan. He was abused. He was threatened. And here he had been invited, like our guest Mong Palatino, to speak with members of the U.S. Senate, the U.S. House of Representatives, and with human rights groups all across the country. What do you make of this incident?
It's disgusting what happened to Jerome. He's a human rights advocate, a human rights worker in the Philippines. He was here to share with church officials, with Congress members, and on a national tour with the general public, the human rights situation in the Philippines, and this is what he was subjected to, that he himself was subjected to human rights violations, grave human rights violations here in the United States at San Francisco International Airport. And to make matters worse, San Francisco is supposedly a sanctuary city. And so we know that torture happened in our very backyards, and it's very upsetting.
Mong Palatino, we were talking amongst ourselves before this show started, and many of us have grave concerns about Jerome Abba's safety. He apparently has already been expelled from the United States. He was only awaiting a seat on a flight back to the Philippines. So he's either there or he's on his way back there. What do you think is going to happen to him?
Well, he is already safely back in the Philippines, and he has already shared his story about his experience at the San Francisco airport. I'd like to clarify that Jerome was invited and he was granted a 10-year multiple entry visa. So there should be no problem about his documents in entering the United States.
That's a good point. That's a very important point. He had a 10-year multiple entry visa, which is very unusual to get a 10-year multiple entry visa. The Customs and Border Control agent who detained him said that there were quote unquote irregularities with the visa. That's nonsense. You either have the visa or you don't have the visa, and he had it.
Yes, and we're questioning the 28-hour detention that they put Jerome into. If there was a problem with his visa, the U.S. Embassy in Manila could have contacted him earlier, prior to his flight, because Jerome has his contact details available to U.S. Embassy officials. And so we are really disappointed and angry with what happened to Jerome, because he was about to testify the human rights abuses in the Philippines, especially the impact of the war on terror on civilian population and drug-related extrajudicial killings across the country.
I want our listeners to know some of the details of what Jerome Aba went through. He says in his statement, and this is a quote, "I was afraid to use the restroom because they might make a drama that I was trying to escape and they might shoot me." He says he was escorted to the restroom by 5 Border Patrol agents. He remembers the main interrogator, an agent bearing the badge with the name Lopez, telling him, quote, "Be good here, be nice here. If you do anything bad, I will not hesitate to shoot you," unquote. Every time I moved, he would reach for his firearm. What kind of treatment, I'm just asking rhetorically, what kind of treatment is that to a man who has a 10-year multiple entry visa and multiple invitations to come here? Now, he is maintaining that he was targeted because of his work in human rights and the fact that he's a Muslim. Now, Donald Trump has been crystal clear about his thoughts and his feelings toward Muslims. Adrian Bonifacio, do you think that's a part of this?
Of course. We know that Trump's Muslim ban has impacted so many other people, and that Jerome is just one of the latest cases of this tactic by Trump, this very Islamophobic tactic, to shut out anyone who's a Muslim and to create this environment of Islamophobia. And to add to that, Jerome is a human rights worker as well. And so not only is he stereotyped as a Muslim by the U.S. government, but he has actively been doing work that exposes the impact of U.S. military aid in the Philippines, in contributing to so many human rights violations. His native island of Mindanao has been a place of extreme conflict in the last almost 1 year because of martial law, a military rule that was imposed on the entire island of Mindanao that the U.S. played a very heavy hand in, that they were providing intelligence, they were providing aid. And one of the cities that was under siege during martial law, Marawi, is now was bombed to rebels. And so Jerome was able to speak with those who were able to experience this firsthand, that were forced into evacuation camps. And so he has those stories from the people who felt the impact of the Philippine military backed by U.S. military aid and the U.S. military itself. The rights violations that went on there. And so, of course, the U.S. government is going to feel threatened that someone, a human rights worker, was coming here to the States to speak with congressional officials, with church peoples, and with the general public of the reality of what's going on in the Philippines and the complicity of the United States government.
That's the voice of Adrian Bonifacio. Adrian is the national chairperson of Anak Bayan USA. We're also joined by Mang Palatino. He is a journalist and former member of the Philippines House of Representatives, who is set to be on the same speaking tour as Jerome Aba. We're speaking to Mang from the Philippines. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Mang, was this at the request, do you think, of Rodrigo Duterte that this happened to Jerome? Or the Filipino government?
We cannot say for certainty that it is a direct order or a recommendation of the Duterte government. But we can say that activists are targeted also by harassment and other intimidation activities by the Duterte government. Just recently, more than 600 activists and grassroots leaders were listed by the Duterte government as terrorists or communist terrorists. And trumped-up cases have been filed against activists. So what happened to Jerome also mirrors the situation of so many activists in the Philippines, especially those who are criticizing the human rights abuses committed by state agents by the government of the Philippines. So both Trump and Duterte use this kind of tactics to silence dissent and to criminalize activism.
Yeah, it's a serious situation. And when you think about, this is what we were worried about, Adrian, when John and I were talking, if Jerome being sent back on the plane, and if it was, in fact, at the request of the Philippine government or the Philippine military, some institution of power in the Philippines, whether or not he would be immediately in jeopardy upon return. But I think Meng was saying he's back and he's safe at the moment. Is safety just a relative term in the Philippines for human rights activists?
Well, safe in a sense that finally he was able to go home to the Philippines. But Jerome, as an activist, as a Muslim human rights activist, we cannot say that he is already secured, because the continuing threats against activists like him, whether online or offline. And what Jerome is doing, revealing or exposing the atrocities committed by state forces, really undermine his security, especially those in the human rights community.
Yeah, I think this is something that we all have to follow and be concerned about and write about and talk about, because otherwise there's a domino effect. And once one activist like this disappears in the system, then nobody is safe.
Yeah, Meng, let me just ask you in our last 40 seconds or so, given the challenges faced by activists in the Philippines from all different sectors, what's the next step for the broader movement? I mean, is there an overarching strategy?
Well, the Duterte government wants to instill fear among the public by terrorizing communities and by filing charges against activists. I think the response should be to continue to strengthen and expand the movement for human rights protection and the strengthening of democracy. We're also appealing for international solidarity to make the Duterte government accountable for the widespread human rights abuses in the country.
All right, John, I think we're going to have to leave it right
yes,
there.
Yes, we're out of time. We were joined from San Jose by Adrian Bonifacio, National Chairperson of Anakbayan USA, and we were joined also by Meng Palatino. He is a journalist and former member of the Philippines House of Representatives, who was set to be on the same speaking tour as Jerome Aba. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. The Taliban announced the start of their annual spring offensive today, dismissing an offer of peace talks by President Ashraf Ghani, but pledging to focus on attacking only U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Ghani has called for peace talks without any preconditions, but the Taliban refused, saying that the offer was a conspiracy. We're joined from Chicago by Brian Terrell, a longtime peace activist and a co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Brian, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Brian, how is this different from any other spring offensive? You know, the spring offensive has sort of become a rite of spring. It happens every single year in Afghanistan. Why is it different this time?
Well, I was surprised to hear it, because usually the spring offensive comes after a winter lull. And we've had a very, very bloody winter, you know, attacks, you know, just a few days ago. A voter registration center in Kabul was attacked, and with many casualties. Just a couple of weeks ago, for the first time in 10 years, the Taliban apparently attacked two schools. So it's very different this year, because it just seems like they're... I really hope this is not an offensive in terms of an uptick on violence from the Taliban, because it's been pretty bad all winter.
Yeah, we spoke on this show back in the fall about decision by the Trump administration to sort of make it a bloody winter. There usually is a winter lull in fighting, and both sides take the time to regroup and do whatever it is they need to do to get ready for a spring offensive. But the Trump administration ordered the U.S. military in Afghanistan to continue fighting throughout the winter. Here we are now in the spring, and I'm looking at a Reuters report that was published this morning, saying that it was an unusually bloody winter with many hundreds of people killed and wounded in a series of high-profile attacks in Kabul since the beginning of the year and heavy fighting going on in several different parts of the country. What's the end game here?
Well, I don't want to be an apologist for the Taliban at all or make excuses for them. But
of course.
But this is driven by the gloves coming off, as the some people in the Trump administration put it last summer, that it's the insurgency is driven by attacks by the United States and its proxies. One thing that the Taliban's statement that came out just said, I'm reading here, that their main effort, the Afghan government's effort, is to deviate public opinion from the illegitimate foreign occupation of the country, as the Americans have no serious or sincere intentions of bringing the war to an end.
Right.
That's what the Taliban says. That's how they see it, and I think it's pretty clearly true. And the peace initiative that President Ashraf Ghani presented doesn't mention the occupation. It's not, that ending the occupation is not a part of the peace initiative that he's inviting the Taliban to sit down to. So, of course, it's a non-starter. It's not nothing that the Taliban is going to consider. And as long as the occupation lasts, and as long as these attacks by the U.S. forces and the Afghan government proxy forces are escalating, the predictable, inevitable, and I'm afraid to say probably intentional result, the only result that can come of it, as almost as a law of physics, will be that there will be more insurgency, and everybody in the government, in the administration, in the Pentagon, in the intelligence community knows this.
You know, one of the things that strikes me, too, is that time does not seem to be on the side of the United States here. The Pentagon estimates that the Taliban controls 56% of Afghanistan. The BBC says that the number is 70% of Afghanistan. And it seems to me that after 16 and a half years, if you only control 30% of the country, you're losing. And maybe it's time to adopt a different strategy, like maybe going home.
Yeah, and I've been to visiting Afghanistan many times since 2010. And the conditions, even in Kabul, where there were never attacks before, are rife. And even the U.S. military now, for a long time, our embassy staff was forbidden to travel in any vehicle but a helicopter. But even the armed convoys that used to be crisscrossing the city of Kabul of American and other NATO troops, they're gone. And even our armed soldiers are travel in the city of Kabul from armed heliport to armed heliport. So the control even in the capital is, which is, I think, one reason why these attacks, horrible attacks the Taliban are doing in Kabul, are to illustrate that the Afghan government doesn't even have its own capital.
Not the first time I was in Afghanistan, but the third or fourth time was 2007. And within the diplomatic area of the U.S., British, French, German embassies, which is completely and totally sealed off from the outside world, you still were not allowed to cross the street to go from one American embassy building to another. And in fact, the Seabees had constructed a tunnel. So you couldn't even go outside, like into the daylight, to go from one American building to another in an otherwise supposedly secure area. You had to go underground to do it. And that was when things were good. That was in 2007.
You know, one of the things that I think is important when we talk about Afghanistan, and you said in the beginning, I don't want to be an apologist or in any way connected to the Taliban. Of course, and of course you're not. Sometimes people who are against the war are sort of a, you know, they're argument against the war is like, oh, you must be sympathizing with the other side. Obviously, nobody's doing that with the Taliban. But one thing I think is important to discuss is that part of the war propaganda of the U.S. justifying what appears to be an endless war in Afghanistan is to talk about how awful the Taliban was as a government. The form of government was so anti-democratic. It was so violative of women's rights. And it was so, you know, anachronistic, taking Afghanistan back hundreds of years. And yet, in other cases, the American government, the U.S. government, has allies who also have completely reprehensible forms of government, including bloody dictatorships, including in the case of Saudi Arabia, for instance, where women are chattel, in essence, belonging to the men in their family as property. When you sort of strip away the issue of the form of government, whether it's good or bad, and just assume the U.S. is not invading or aligning with countries based on their form of government, because fundamentally it doesn't seem to really matter. There's other things driving foreign policy. If we think past that issue and just think about what the U.S. goals are in Afghanistan. We've talked about this before, Brian. The Taliban now control a big part of Afghan territory. What's the American goal? Is it to stop the Taliban from controlling all of Afghan territory? In other words, just not being defeated by the Taliban, or is there something else?
Well, I think it's, as to quote the Taliban statement again, is that there isn't any interest in resolving this. And I don't think that the Taliban can be defeated militarily, and that perhaps is not even the intention, because if peace would break out, we'd have to stop the war, and we'd have to allow the people of Afghanistan to form a civil society that would take the needs and desires of the people of Afghanistan in consideration, and they would be making pacts and be trading with their neighbors and friends, including Iran and China, and we want the instability of Afghanistan is in the interests of the people running the United States and the military-industrial complex. It's selling weapons. It's also keeping the mineral wealth and the access to pipelines that everybody wants to build across Afghanistan, keeping them out of the hands of people that we would like to keep more, we don't want to see having power in that region, even though they live in that region. It's about keeping our control, and chaos is the best way, I think, that's going to happen. So we'll keep feeding this war with the knowledge that there will be repercussions, and then we'll have more reason to be there. And historically, of course, the Taliban never, ever would have been in power without the United States aiding it through the 1980s, at the time of after the Soviet invasion. It's unthinkable that the Taliban would even exist if it were not for U.S. interference in the region.
That's undoubtedly true. But in this case, John Kiriakou, the war is not a means to an end, as Brian is pointing out. It is the end.
It is the end. And as we've said a million times, we have transitioned in this country to a full-time war economy. And Brian's right. The point is not to win the war. The point is to just keep the war going. That's really what it comes down to. And I regret that we're going to have to end it there. We were joined from Chicago by Brian Terrell, a longtime peace activist and a co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Pakistan's former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is on trial in that country on a myriad of corruption charges. He and his family have been major political players in Pakistan for much of the past 30 years and have been accused of corruption before. But allegations of Sharif having assets beyond his means, leaked as part of the Panama Papers, may be enough to finally put him in prison. We're joined from Washington by Marvin Weinbaum. He's the scholar-in-residence for the Middle East Institute's Center for Pakistan Studies. Marvin, welcome back. We're always glad to have you.
My pleasure.
Marvin, Nawaz Sharif was in London, and he did not have to return to Pakistan for this trial. He elected to return. Did he do that because he's innocent, or is he trying to save his political reputation, or was there some other reason?
Well, he's in London because his wife is serious. She's a cancer patient being treated there, and she's very seriously ill. So he has legitimate reason for leaving periodically. So he's there. Why does he? That's right. He could stay abroad and perhaps, like others have, he could avoid the judicial system. That's not uncommon. However, to do so would be destroy his entire legacy and what and the party that he built up. It would redound very badly politically for all those who are associated with him, and I think would do terrible damage, as I say, to his political party. So he firmly believes that the system has turned into what he calls, and he just the other day referred to as becoming a judicial dictatorship, and he's really at war now with the country's judiciary.
He really is. He said last week, he's attended more than 50 of these hearings so far, and he said last week he criticized the judges, saying that they were members of an undemocratic force. He said these corruption cases have been fabricated and are fake, and he said people are ultimate decision makers in a democracy, and I hope that they will vote us into power again, he said. I think you're right, too, and I wanted to point out that he's 68 years old now, and he's not going to be a force in Pakistani politics forever. But his daughter Miriam is ready to take the reins of the party.
Well, she's under judicial acts as well.
As well as her husband.
The charges against him, her husband and his two sons. It goes much beyond Nawaz Sharif.
So where does that leave the Pakistan Muslim League, the party that Nawaz Sharif founded and has led?
Well, it will survive, although there's talk about how one of its premier members may be switching now to Imran Khan's party. But if there were an election were held today, there's a good chance that it would have a plurality and be able to form a government with the help of independents. The election won't take place perhaps until October, and everybody's expecting it will take place. His party really, all this time, has really been about the Sharif family. And it goes back to the late 1980s, when it was formed, interestingly, by the actions, really, of the military, who were looking for a counterweight to Benazir Bhutto's People's Party, Pakistan People's Party.
Yeah, let's just talk, Marvin, for a moment so that people here in the United States can understand this interplay between judicial authorities, legal charges, prosecutions, and politics itself in the case of Pakistan. Of course, next year will be the 40th anniversary of the execution of then 51-year-old Ali Bhutto, who had been prime minister and representing the Pakistan People's Party. Educated in, I believe, in Berkeley and Oxford, finally executed, and many others who had the position of prime minister ultimately, either while they're in office or after office, either become the targets of the military or the targets of judicial authorities. Just talk about how this interplay, this sort of story keeps happening over and over again.
Well, look, there is rampant corruption in the country. And it's hard to find a politician who can't in some way be seen as vulnerable. When Nawaz Sharif said it's all, put up charges, not quite. I think everybody would agree that he just got targeted. And whether it was the military or a increasingly independent judiciary, or a combination of that. In any event, they went further in prosecuting him when they could pretty much prosecute a wide variety of people in political life. So he's right in the sense that he was singled out here, but it's not because he had clean hands and all this was fabricated. He's part of his political class. And it's notorious for having its hands in the till. No one more than the recent head of the PPP, which the husband of Benazir Bhutto, and he was notorious for having taken bribes, and yet was elected prime minister by his party. Because the prime minister is chosen by the party, but people, when they vote, recognize also who is likely to be the country's head of government when they cast their ballot. I don't know if that gets at what you're asking about, but I think we have to put it in that context. Now, the Panama Papers did reveal that he had all kinds of sources that were not revealed in various companies, flats in London, and other sundry things that would make him judicially liable. But what the court has done now in recent years is it's become, yes, independent, and everybody's in favor of an independent judiciary. But it seems to a lot of people to have overstepped now its boundaries and to take it upon itself as the judge and jury. So much so that even, you know, something which is just this last week when the Chief Justice Nisar announced that he was, now the court was going to take up human rights issues and education and so on, all very valid subjects, especially given the abuse of human rights and social rights in the country. But he was going to do that, and he can do that in Pakistan independently of the legislature or the executive. And they have something called sui moto. And that is something that we do not give to our courts, and that is the ability to issue what in effect are advisory opinions. In our courts, you've got to have a real controversy that comes before the court, and then it's only under certain circumstances that the Supreme Court will hear it. Well, using this judicial avenue of sui moto, what they're able to do is to simply assert their views and to back them up through their use of judicial power, particularly their power to bring people in contempt of court. And they've got all kinds of people now who are, aside from this Panama Papers and the Nawaz's party, who are being held in contempt of court. And it does strike a lot of people who are close to it that this has gotten out of hand.
Just as an aside, I happened to be visiting Benazir Bhutto once at her house in Dubai. She was in exile there. And while we were sitting in the living room talking, a car pulled up. And this look of utter exasperation showed on her face. And she said, "Oh, if that's Zardari with another Bentley, I am going to flip out."
Oh, yeah.
And I laughed, yeah. And I thought, my God, the depth of corruption. But that's Pakistan. And, you know, it leads to a question for me. First of all, I have to agree with everything you've said about the Pakistani judiciary. It really wants to do the right thing and to impose the rule of law and have people, parties, respect the law. But it seems like every time the government turns over there, there's a prosecution. Why is that? And we have about 60 seconds left.
Well, look, what it is, I think that there's a good feeling here within the military, and I think you have to see the military as an important player here, that they would like to see, they'd like to clear the decks of the political class. They'd like to see a new breed of politician come in. They're not happy with governance in the country. They know they can't do it. When they do it badly. So that may sound all well and good, but it's not democracy, and that's the problem here. We still is supposedly a democracy there where the people choose and not the military and not the courts.
That's it. That's it right there. Well, thank you. Marvin Weinbaum joined us from Washington. He's the scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute's Center for Pakistan Studies.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back with more after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Facebook yesterday made public for the very first time a 27-page memo explaining the criteria for banning content on its site. The company also said that it would be more clear about its privacy policies in light of a new European Union law mandating transparency. Meanwhile, Twitter has released its privacy policy to the public. We're joined from Lausanne, Switzerland by Professor Brian Ford. Professor Ford leads the Decentralized Distributed Systems Lab at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne. Welcome, Professor Ford.
Thank you.
So what should we make of this 27-page memo, the commitment to transparency? These companies, most notably Facebook and Twitter, appear to be saying the right things. Does this really herald a change? Is this going to improve things for users?
Well, I think they're certainly saying some of the right things, but I think they're frankly doing what they have to do and kind of the minimum. I think the minimum they can get away with to proceed and regain some public respect, in light of the situation. The deeper truth we have to keep in mind is that these are companies that generally their fundamental business model is predicated on collecting massive amounts of people's data and using that to target advertisements in ever finer grained fashion. And so, we have to, just expect and understand that they're going to do, they're going to comply with the laws, such as the incoming GDPR law and things like that. They're going to do what they have to, what we force them to do, but probably nothing more, as far as I can see.
Well, I'm wondering, too, if this has been forced on Facebook and Twitter by the Europeans and they've decided to just take the opportunity to extend the same policies now to the United States to try to take some of the congressional heat off of themselves. Do you think that's the case, or do they really intend to change the way they treat information?
Yeah, so I don't have any particularly special insight there. I can only speculate, like pretty much anyone else outside of those companies. But I think it's very likely that a lot of what they're doing is indeed basically inspired by what they have to do anyway to comply with the European GDPR law, which I think is a hugely positive development for not only for Europe but for the world, because it'll in effect be easier for a lot of companies to comply just worldwide with the requirements of the GDPR, rather than trying to implement special cases for different parts of the world. And so I think it's quite natural and understandable that these companies will use their efforts, which I'm sure they've been planning for a long time now, to comply with the GDPR. You use those efforts to, as you say, take some of the heat off from the current scandals.
Let's talk for a moment more about the GDPR, the new General Data Protection Regulation. I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal from yesterday. The headline it's an interesting sort of second story about this big story. Brian Ford, and the headline is Europe's new consumer privacy law gives edge to tech giants. Google and Facebook benefit while smaller players are squeezed. And then the article goes in about how the European Union's Justice Commissioner traveled to California to meet Google and Facebook executives about this new regulations. And when she got there, she expected to have sort of a tense meeting, but they were very, very relaxed. Very kind of all right with everything. And the article goes on to explain that on May 25th, the EU will begin enforcing the new rules, which in many cases require companies to obtain affirmative consent to use European residents' personal information. The change has sent shudders through the digital advertising sector, from online publishers to the analytic firms, data brokers, etc. And what the article is basically saying is that Facebook and Google, because they're so big, their capital base is so vast, that they can actually make these kind of adjustments where smaller companies will really feel the squeeze and, in fact, could be squeezed out. In other words, it could be accelerating a monopoly trend. Anything to that?
Yeah, I think that fear is definitely justified. There certainly are ways that the GDPR could indeed make things easier for the big players. In fact, one of the non-financial, more direct procedural reasons is the GDPR. In terms of all the GDPR's disclosure requirements, the requirements that companies make, tell the user what they're collecting and stuff. This is going to cause a lot of websites and a lot of companies to have to present users with click through. Click this checkbox to proceed. Read the terms or click to indicate you comply with the checkbox. And when for really big players like Facebook and Google, they kind of do that once, and then the users spend a lot of time on their websites. They don't have to do that very often, and users will be okay with that. They won't be that annoyed. Whereas a lot of the small players, the first time you get to their website, you'll be bombarded with these click through requirements, and so when you go to a smaller player's website, you tend to do so less frequently, and on average you'll get a much worse user experience. So that's just one example. Another example is of the way it could help big players is that Facebook and Twitter and Google and companies like that have a lot of different opportunities and different kind of feeds and information sources to which to gather and aggregate data. And once they've done complied with those user notification requirements, then there's a tremendous amount of processing they can do just with the data they have that they collected and they essentially have practical ownership of, even under the or stewardship of under the terms of the GDPR. Whereas a lot of smaller players, in order to try to compete with the big players in terms of being able to use data and things like that, they have to aggregate data, share data with other players, to participate in data markets. And that the GDPR will make that the processes for around those kinds of data exchanges a lot harder and more complex and in some cases likely impossible. Personally, being a privacy person, I think that's a good thing for privacy. But this unbalancing things toward the big players is not necessarily a good thing for privacy, certainly.
And there's some other unintended consequences, or maybe they're not unintended consequences. A lot of progressive grassroots activists, nonprofits, all kinds of organizations use Nation Builder to do their website, to do their email, to do their social media. And then it helps aggregate and collect information and allow people to build a grassroots online presence. Facebook is blocking apps now that have access to lots of data, and that includes Nation Builder, for instance. They say they're going to do a full review of such apps and policies before possibly turning this back on. It means that websites that link to Facebook events will no longer pull into their database the names of people who have RSVP'd, for instance. It will also mean that the system will not be able to easily find and link email addresses to Facebook profiles. These are the things that smaller companies that are servicing people online also utilize as a service that they're performing. Can you talk a little bit about that, Brian?
Indeed, that's definitely one of the big problems for smaller companies, especially smaller companies that have been built their businesses around Facebook's APIs and the APIs of the big companies, and this is one of the effects that again could well benefit the biggest players most by essentially giving them an excuse to keep a much more privileged position in terms of the data they can internally access and use, but essentially lock out the smaller players that might be partly competing with them while using their APIs. This is a really pretty bad unintended consequence. Well, you know, it could well be intended by some parties, but on the other hand, we have to go back and recognize that we kind of dug ourselves into this unfortunate situation by, you know, for years now, supporting these kind of walled garden business models by supporting, you know, and using companies like Facebook and apps that rely on Facebook and kind of go through Facebook rather than going through and relying on only the open internet and the open internet protocols, you know, which was always an option, but we were collectively, I think, seduced into these walled garden environments, being promised that, well, you know, Facebook will provide, and these companies will provide so many great services. And, you know, here's when the chickens come home to roost.
Yeah, there's a price to pay for that. We're out of time, unfortunately. We were joined from Lausanne, Switzerland by Professor Brian Ford. Professor Ford leads the Decentralized Distributed Systems Lab at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're done for the day. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. You can follow us now at Twitter, at Loud Clear Radio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.